Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
From Blue Rock Station. And today we're going to talk about what it means to be a soil farmer. And that includes composting toilets. Or, as we wanted to, the subtitle of this one, let them all rot. That's right. Let it all rot. So, anyway, Annie, you like to talk about how, you know, you are the farmer. You're the farmer at Blue Rock Station, and I don't want to be the farmer. I would kill
it's
every
a good thing.
I'd kill every
thing.
Plant, every animal, and, you know, the planet as well. But you like to say that you are a soil farmer when people come, and that's the crop you raise mostly. So what do you mean by that? What do you mean when you say you're a soil farmer?
Well, what I like to say is I'm a soil farmer, and that's where everybody ought to be, because I don't care where you live, you can be making soil. So what I mean by that in my life is that if it will rot, then that's what we do with it. So we have special place for our kitchen compost. We have lots of waste that comes out of the barns from deep bedding in the wintertime, and then all the poo the warm months. We have dead carcasses that, because if you have livestock, you'll have dead stock, and anything that rots. So that's really the heart of it. And I think the challenge that we have in our culture is that we don't want to think about these things. So we think if we, we have a little container in the kitchen, and that's where everything goes that's coming out of kitchen scraps. And granted, a great deal of that goes to the pigs or goes to the chickens, and then whatever they can't use goes to the compost facility. But the other thing is they're creating all kinds of waste that helps us create soil. And we have a farm that is 38.2 acres of clay. So in order for us to produce food and also healthy pasture, we've got to be able to create better soil, more microbes in the soil, more nutrients in the soil. And that's what we're doing when we are soil farmers.
Well, it seems to me, you know, the idea of composting, and compost is one of those areas I think most people are familiar with and maybe not familiar with. Because, as you say, anything that's organic in nature, if it's just left to its own devices, lay it down on the ground somewhere, it's gonna return to its basic elements. It's going to rot, whether that's a person or a piece of newspaper or food scraps. So why isn't in our society everything that is organic in nature being composted? Seems like such a no-brainer.
Well, because it's out of sight, out of mind, and we don't, as human beings in this culture, we just want to be able to throw it away and be done with it, and we don't want to have to think about where it's going to go. We want to flush the toilet, and voila, it's gone, and that means I don't have to deal with it. And it's the same with any kind of things that could potentially create soil. And one of the challenges is that at some point we're going to have to be soil farmers, because so much of the land that's used in agriculture today is just totally bankrupt of the minerals that we need. So, for example, lots and lots of the food that we buy at the grocery store, it's created and grown because it's got to travel a long way. And so there's a study done recently. It was done over a period of time, but it was released recently that showed that in the 1930s, when we ate food, we were getting about 80 to 90% of the minerals that we needed and the nutrients we needed from that food. That very same food, because we eat a lot of the same kinds of food that people did in the 30s, today only gives us about 30% of the minerals and the nutrients that we need. Well, we can't do too well physically with that kind of loss, with that kind of discrepancy in our mineral and nutrient intake. So if we're creating, if we're being soil farmers, if we're even, so if I lived in an apartment, but I've got a really nice window box, or maybe I have several pots that I grow things in, over a period of time, it would be possible if you got yourself some worms and had a worm bin, you could generate enough nutrients in that, and that would have to be diluted. You could share it with your neighbors. But we're all going to come to this because the soil is just too depleted.
Well, one of the things that you said about, you know, you want to flush it and it's gone and out of sight, out of mind, it does strike me, because that was a realization for me anyway, because of course I was a suburban kid who believed Wonder Bread built strong bodies 12 ways and that the president never lied and that if you worked hard and played by the rules, you could succeed. And all of these lovely illusions that you have divested me of over the years. And thank you very much for that. But
if only I had that power.
But it is comforting to just flush it and it goes away and it's someone else's problem. But wait
until the toilet backs up,
well,
and then that's a whole nother.
That's when you call a plumber and you go away for a while. So, you know, this is. But living at Blue Rock Station, you know, all of our systems are closed systems. So,
well, wait, what does that mean?
Well, they don't go anywhere. Everything stays right there. So if we put something down the sink, it goes to a gray water holding tank. So if you put something really nasty down the sink, like bleach or something like that, you've got to deal with the effects of that right there and right
pretty,
now.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah, same as if something goes in the composting toilet that is not going to compost. You're going to have to deal with it.
Well, that's interesting, too, just to say something about that, because people think when they use the composting toilet that whatever they put down there, nobody's going to know it's there. But when we go to empty the toilet and it's this really nice composted soil and it smells lovely, and then there'll be some evidence of a tampon or some other piece of plastic that somebody's thrown in there. And so it doesn't really go away. It just becomes somebody else's problem.
Right. And you know, that really is the American way, though, to make your problem someone else's problem.
Yeah.
You know, I think we want. So speaking of toilets, because that's the thing I think of all of the utilities at Blue Rock Station when people come to visit. That's the one that freaks them out the most. You know, here's this composting toilet. So what are the issues?
I think more than the composting toilet is the fact that the public toilet is called the Privy with the $1 million view. And as you like to say, you'll fix something twice, but the third time you're not fixing it anymore. And so in the wintertime, we have a lot of wind out of the west, and it kept blowing the door off. So we don't have a door on the toilet, and it faces to the holler. So it's really a beautiful view. And I think people are really scared about that. And because we're Americans, we have a lot of problems with our habits. And then also the fact that it's composting toilet. Anyway, the composting toilet is pretty simple. It has a barrel inside of it that's turned on its side, and it has an opening into that barrel. And then when you first start with the toilet, you've got to introduce some really cool microbes, which come in a little bottle, and you just dump them in there with some sawdust. And the toilet begins working. And so what it does is, as you make deposits into the toilet, it begins to decompose pretty rapidly. It heats up the material, and it decomposes and turns into this very nice brown, crumbly soil. And the way you get it to do that is you've got to add some kind of roughage. So usually it's some form of wood chips, really fine wood chips like sawdust. And you've got to have the right mix of that, or it doesn't work properly. And then air. So the barrel has a turning a handle on it, so you can turn the barrel periodically after it's had deposits put in it. And then you have soil. So it's a really cool system. It costs, in 1996, it cost $1,500. So I like to say that to people when they're being all snooty about it, because I'm sure their toilet didn't cost $1,500. And the toilet has, you know, it really does sometimes get overloaded in a way if there's too many people. But we know that, so we deal with it.
Right. And we should point out here in Ohio, composting toilets are legal. There may be local restrictions that you'll need to check on. But as long as the toilet is UL certified, the state of Ohio will allow you to utilize composting toilets. And which is kind of funny, because a composting toilet, as you said, is really just a big plastic bucket that you put waste material in and add some sawdust and the like and turn it.
Which you're allowed to do. You're allowed to do that in your yard with something else. But so we had a medical doctor who was an intern with us once, and he was very interested in the whole concept of, we had these humanure buckets, and we had the composting toilets, and then we were mixing that all, and then we were using it in our raised beds. And I like to say dilution is the solution, and the idea that we were diluting the material and it was rotting and the microbes were doing their work, it wasn't going to be a problem. So he did some testing and he did some research, and he came back and he said, look, you're doing everything right and it's not a problem. The only problem would be if you have people who are using a lot of pharmaceutical products, and that really could mess up the compost. But that isn't a problem. We don't use pharmaceuticals, and the people who come, if they use the toilet, it isn't that much that's being added, so it's being heavily diluted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the fallacies that we hear a lot about is people are usually okay with the idea of using, you know, animal manure in their gardens. But human manure, for whatever reason, they've decided is somehow not going to be safe. But if it is properly composted, and of course that requires that the compost get to a certain temperature and compost for a certain period of time, but properly composted material, whether it's animal material or human material, is just fine in the garden. The problem you're going to run into, as the doctor had said, was pharmaceuticals, other chemicals that may have been introduced. And we ran into this when we got a load of manure from the fairgrounds. I mean, you
horse manure.
Yeah, because that's one of those things where you get a load for the garden, and it turned out it was full of oil filters and hypodermic needles, and that the animals that had been using that or providing the manure had been so full of wormer that we couldn't get worms to live in the garden for years after that. So,
well, I just want to bring up one thing before we run out of time, and that is that we have recently become a zero waste facility. And that's a project from Rural Action, where they work with businesses, and they called us the rock star of zero waste, and that was pretty cool. But we work at it, and so nobody's ever going to be really zero waste, but it's a great thing to try to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you're listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, and reminding you that
it is the end of the world as we know it. And thank God.
Okay, that was not that exciting here. It's the end of the world as we know it. Okay, it is the end of the world. And of course, it's the end of the compost as we know it. So so anyway, you were talking about zero waste and the zero waste program. So what are some of the things that are involved in that?
Well, they send you a survey, and you fill out and answer a lot of questions about how you deal with different things that are a part of your business, you know, like food scraps, and depending on the kind of business, you're going to have, you know, different kind of answers. And then they come and they do an audit, and they look at all the different ways that you deal with waste or don't deal with waste. And for example, we had a big party for Day of the Dead, and it had a lot of this really horrendous Mexican candy, and I had on purpose put it into the garbage can because it was impossible to get the wrappers off of it to throw it in the compost. They were all stuck in on it, and it was just amazing. I guess I could have soaked it in water, but I didn't think of that. Well, anyway, so they were in the garbage. I just wanted to be honest. And then when they came, they took all the garbage out, and they weighed what was in the garbage, and they looked at, did I have anything in there that could be reused or anything that could have gone into the compost? And, of course, there was the candy. So but they didn't hold that against us. They said that our biggest challenge is our visitors, that they don't have enough respect for our way of life, and that we need better signage to help them understand when they bring things that cannot be reused or recycled or repurposed or composted, that they have to take them back with them. So that's Zero Waste Program, and it's a good idea because it helps us all to be thinking about how to be, as you say, what do you call that? When you said nets,
carbon negative.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what we're going for. You know, we're gonna make up for some other folks. So.
I also wanted to say something about plastic wrap, because a lot of people love plastic wrap, and I actually have never liked it. It's irritating. It never does what you want it to anyway. And so many years ago, I stopped using it. I do have this huge roll of stuff that I got at Goodwill one time, and it's some industrial roll or whatever. I've had it for like 15 years, and we do occasionally use one piece of it for something. But we use wax paper, and I love wax paper. It reminds me of being a kid in school when I got to take my lunch and my sandwich would be wrapped up in that wax paper, and it would just seem so special. So we use wax paper for everything because when it goes into the compost, within a couple of days, it will be decomposed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny how our products are so packaged. And it just reminded me when you're talking about wrapping up your sandwiches in wax paper. And when I was a kid, you know, it was so exciting that they had these individually wrapped pieces of cheese, you know, those little slices of cheese. And one
time, you mean
time,
it's not cheese, is it?
It's kind of cheese-looking stuff. And so I had made a cheese sandwich, and I was eating it at school. And I thought, oh, you know, the cheese is frozen. But it turned out I was, like, chewing through the plastic wrap. And that was not biodegradable, by the way.
You know, the problem with somebody that has a really high IQ, they have those moments in life.
Okay. Well, just keep telling me that. I'll accept that. So anyway, speaking of children and lunches, I mean, we've had some school groups there, and it's interesting some of the issues we've had with especially the parents, as far as because one of the things that you always insist upon is that their lunches, if they bring their lunches, must be zero waste, basically.
Well, they need to be in a container that can be reused 100 times. That could be a shoebox, a backpack. I mean, people lack imagination, but there's a lot of complaining from the parents because they don't want to have a special container. There's no Lunchables because that's not real food. But we have kids in the past, not recently, but in the past who had never had a plum. They've eaten fruit in a container, but they didn't know what it was. They've never had a peach. They never had anything but white bread, so they don't want to eat it. This is a big challenge, particularly with kids that we've met from the inner city and rural kids. It seems like they have a lot of the same issues around food. And the parents, well, just to say a really good story is we did a project with an elementary school where we helped kids, every kid in the 10th grade, in the 5th grade, they were 10 years old, to build a solar oven. And we called it our couch potato version of solar ovens. And so every kid, 150 kids, built these ovens, and then we were going to have a cook-off. And we wanted the kids to experience fresh food, so they had a choice in their class to decide, were they going to make chutney, which they love the name of that because it means to tickle your nose, or they could make salsa, and then they would have nachos because we wanted them to have something familiar. And they were very excited to make the products out of locally produced food. And when we had the cook-off, we were in the parking lot. The parents were invited, the superintendent of schools, everybody could come. And the kids they ate everything. They didn't, you know, put their noses up at it. They were just so excited and thrilled to try something new that they had been a part of and that the ovens worked and they got as hot as we said they would and everything. And the parents stood over in the corner of the parking area and said, "We're not eating that." And there was the rub, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's just get rid of the adults.
Most adults could just go away because the kids really, when we show them the science, when we show them that they can do this for themselves, they get super excited about it. They're willing to try. I know this is true. I work with a group of kids, fourth graders in Columbus in inner city, and they hatch eggs from Blue Rock Station as part of a science program that they have. And these are kids that have had a rough life. Many of them have never even been out of Columbus. They've been in trouble with the law already. And when they hatch those chicks and raise those chicks and hold those chicks, they just become somebody that the teacher doesn't even recognize. And she's very committed to having them do this because every year it's the same reaction. And I see this when kids grow food. I see this when kids cook and make foods for themselves that are new. They can get it. It's the parents that often are the problem, teaching them that they shouldn't try. They shouldn't be interested.
Well, when you're talking about the animals, because, you know, when we have the tours, and one of the things you like to say about every animal has a purpose, and one of the main purposes the animals at Blue Rock Station have is
pooping.
That's right, providing compost. So
they don't provide compost, they poop, then it becomes compost.
Right. So what are some of the issues that you run into with that? Because we haul a lot of manure. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of manure to move.
Well, we on purpose try to have lots of manure. But it isn't just manure, so they're not standing in manure. So in the summer, everything is cleaned twice a day wherever they are. So if they go in a stall and they're exploring or they're in the barnyard, that all gets swept and cleaned every single day. But once it starts getting chilly out, we want to have a warmer area for them. And so we do what's called deep bedding, and we feed hay in the stalls then, and they have some big stalls where they can go and sleep, and they have their preferences of where. And so it's kind of layered, if you think about it. So they're eating hay, and they're very wasteful. Then they're pooping, and then the hay gets covered over, gets the poop covered over, and then the poop covers over the hay. And so we just keep letting that happen over the winter, and it gets very, very warm. So it's like a warm mattress.
Well, that's something people need to understand is through the composting action, heat is given off. I mean, a composting pile can get quite hot.
Yeah,
and
the methane
kick off some steam.
Right, the methane is like if we move the pile even today, if it was cooler at night, you would see a lot of steam coming off of it. And in fact, it would be so hot you wouldn't be able to put your hand down through the center of it because it would burn you. And that's what we want to have happen.
Well, in fact, we have an intern who's working on an experiment, because a big issue with the livestock in this area that gets cold in the wintertime is freezing. So there's a certain amount of energy for the water. Freezing the water. So we're looking at creating a system where the water runs through deep bedded compost and takes the heat from that compost to keep the water from freezing. So that's another way of using these natural systems that are going to occur anyway, and harvesting that energy to offset what would have to be electrical energy in this case. So,
well, let me just finish about how we do the composting with the deep bedding. So in the spring then, we muck out, or we take all of the deep bedding out, and we have different places that we will put it for different reasons. And that then eventually decomposes enough to create a really rich compost that we can put in the raised beds that we have. And we have quite a number of raised beds at Blue Rock Station. The other thing is, as I said before, if you have livestock, at some point you're going to have dead stock. But not just that, we also have sometimes predators that we have to kill, because they're going to kill our chickens. And so we have to dispose of the bodies. Well, in the early days, I would dig a grave, but then we had a llama die, and it was going to storm, and I didn't want anybody to be out in the storm trying to dig the grave. So I decided to take all of the muck from the summer stalls that we were always cleaning out and cover the llama with it. And I covered it really, really well. I mean, like several feet on top of the llama. And it was interesting to me, because when we got ready to move all the compost, I knew where the body had been, because, not because I remembered exactly, because by then there was quite a big mound, but because that compost had different kinds of microbes in it than the other compost, and the soil was black as black could be. So that's how we also utilize animals. We want to have those microbes from that decaying mammal or bird. If we have some chickens, sometimes we don't use the dead chicken that way. Sometimes we'll freeze it and use it as bait if we need to catch a predator. But mostly we're going to bury it. And that enriches our composting pile tremendously with microbes that we need for that process to go quickly and also to enrich. You know, microbes are super important for a lot of reasons. It's why plants do well or don't do well for the most part, if they get enough rain and they get enough sunshine. But the other part of it is that they also eat parasites. And so we want to encourage microbes and the right kind of microbes in our pastures, because particularly goats have a lot of issues around parasites. And that's getting to be a big problem for all livestock in North America, as far as death and disease and everything, is these parasites that exist on grass blades in the pastures.
So something as simple as composting, it's kind of it really is, you know, the kumbaya cycle of life, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
Because of course, we eat the nutrients that come from the soil that is providing the vegetables or the animals and the like, and then you process that, and any of the waste is compostable, and then our bodies and the bodies of animals other is all compostable. And if we would just stay out of it, you know, the whole cycle is pretty
amazing.
Self-sustaining. Yeah. And so of course, then we get into the whole introduction of plastics, which is a big issue.
Can I talk about that?
No, you can't. Yes, you can. No, this show is brought to you by Exxon. No, so talk away. Talk about plastics.
Well, I wanted to say that probably about maybe 8 or 9 years ago, we were speaking at a conference, and we went to eat, and they announced that they had biodegradable plates and tableware. So I decided I wanted to know if that was true or not, because I didn't believe it. So I went back and I asked the chef, could I please have a bag of the plates and the table service, a big plastic bag of it. And so we brought it home and we put it in several places where we had things that were composting. And 2 years later, nothing was composted. So I took the table service.
None of the silverware that they claimed was compostable was composted, right?
No,
the other
wasn't.
Organic
no.
material was fine.
Oh, yeah, any food, but even the plates weren't composted. They were made of corn, some corn derivative, and they were not composted yet. So it told me that they would have to have a huge amount of heat and artificial heat to make them compost, which defeats the whole purpose. So anyway, so for years, I used the table service as markers in my beds. I wrote on them, and when they got super hot, they would bend a bit, which made me think, wow, they must be outgassing. And anyway, so I think, you know, there is not always truth in advertising, and green costs money.
Hold it. Back up. You're saying advertising is deceptive?
Well, about biodegradable things.
Oh, okay.
All right,
I'll accept that. The rest is all true, right? Wonder Bread still does build strong
No, it doesn't
bodies.
Build anything but heartache. So you're all right. You're not eating it now. You've changed your ways. Anyway, so I just think that it's really important for us to ask these questions and to always say we don't think it's true, so you convince us, because green costs money and sustainability takes honesty.
Okay, well, those subversive thoughts. Just remind you, you've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank you for spending a bit of time with us. And as your grandmother probably told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and eat your vegetables.
Eat your vegetables in composted soil. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
I will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed.